Hello, wonderful humans. I hope y'all had a wonderful Thanksgiving. And today we will be going over two cases again, as promised.
It's only one today. We're only doing one case, and it's my case, and that's it.
I guess I'll be making a second episode alone, but
I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know. So the case that we'll be going over, the cases that we'll be going over today is the case of Richard Ramirez and the case of Joan Reich. So tune in, grab yourself. Okay, if you're listening to this, pause the podcast and go get yourself water.
Or like water. A snack or something if you really want to, I guess.
But also water. Water is good for your body.
I like a mint. Mints are nice.
So get comfortable, tune in, and I don't know, turn on your light because these cases are kind of creepy. So,
I mean, yeah, I am going to be talking. Well, he is dead now, which is unfortunate because he needed to be full extent of the law, you know what I mean?
But, oh my god, I literally, okay, I'm sorry, but there's been so many cases I hear where the person like goes to prison and like commits suicide, and I'm like, no, you freaking coward. Like, I'm talking
what happened to him, but I do understand what you mean.
Yeah, no, there's been so many times where, like, the person that was like convicted goes to prison and like commits suicide. It's like, you coward, you deserve to rot in the jail cell.
Yep.
But,
or, you know, I'm a firm believer that the death penalty should be kind of still implemented. But not for crimes that are of a lesser nature. Like, if you get the death penalty for freaking selling drugs, that's a little much.
That's not legal.
Yeah.
I've done actually 3 or 4 research papers in my time in high school, all on different parts of the death penalty or capital punishment in general. And different takes on it, different outlooks. Like, it's crazy, the whole, how it all developed, how it's all going. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's way more shocking than people think it is, like, how it started and how it's developing. Like, it was banned for years. It's so weird.
Yeah.
But
basically, if you murder and rape a child, you should totally go and die by lethal injection. Heck, we can even bring back the guillotine for all I care.
I feel like it really depends on the person. And my reason for saying that is there are several types of serial killers, several profiles of serial killers. And for ones, to me, like Charles Manson, who did not get death penalty, he died in like 2017 in prison. He should have gotten the death penalty. And my reason for saying that is because he was an insane person. He had no regrets and no regards for what he did. And that's why I believe he should have been sentenced to death. Whereas somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer, who did end up feeling remorse, feeling guilt, he should have spent his life in prison because that was a better punishment for him. You know?
I can kind of agree, but I also feel like
he has to spend the rest of his life thinking about what he did, being miserable because of all the lives that he took.
But I also feel like a lot of times these people are not necessarily remorseful. They're manipulative, and they're using the fact that, oh, this is a normal human emotion that I know I should be feeling. I feel like about 10 years in, I should be, remorseful over the fact that I killed these people, but in actuality, I don't really feel a thing.
But there are actual serial killers out there that you can tell just from the literal way that they kill people is like, oh, the minute this person did it, they felt remorse. But there's a different reason for why they actually kill. It's a totally psychological game. And so there are a ton of serial killers that feel remorse for what they did. They're perfectly aware that what they're doing is wrong and that they shouldn't have done it. But it doesn't stop them from doing it because it's a sexual release from being traumatized. It's crazy. It's ridiculous. It's insane. I have mixed feelings about death penalty. I'm not against it. I think that it should be something that happens, but I think that you need to look at the person and have a psychological evaluation and truly decide what is worse for them. do they want to die or do they want to spend their life in prison? If they want to spend their life in prison, sentence them to death penalty, because you know what? They don't deserve to have that pleasure. If they want to die because it sucks, well, guess what? They're going to rot in prison for the rest of their life because they took this many lives, you know?
Yeah, but I also feel like they could completely manipulate the system, and that's the sense. Like, if you're like, oh, haha, if you want to do this, you're going to get this, then a lot of killers are going to be like, oh, I regret what I did.
Well,
I'm
I
sorry.
Don't mean it like that. I just mean a full psychological evaluation of what is going on. Because you can't really play a psychological evaluation, you know? I don't know. I just feel like it really depends on the person whether or not they get death penalty. And I think that the system should definitely be switched up because it's kind of weird. But
yeah.
Anyways, let's go on to the cases. You are going to be first this week, Richard Ramirez.
I am going to be first this week. So basically, if you are from the LA area, you will know that I did an LA one last week. But I am also doing another one this week because I'm sorry, California. But you got some messed up people living there, bro. There are some people there that should not, like, exist. And one of those people was Richard Frickin' Ramirez, also known as the Night Stalker, and also known who's also known as the Night Stalker and the Valley Killer, and yeah, so basically, and the Valley Intruder as well. And so he's not to be confused with the original Night Stalker, also known as the Golden State Killer, because they were two different things. The original Night Stalker happened in the 1970s to the 1980s. And then there are some other kills that weren't really attributed to him till later. But the Night Stalker, or the Valley Intruder, happened strictly between a kind of two-year period. But basically, Richard Ramirez was a monster born as Ricardo Leyva, I don't know how to pronounce this, Munez Ramirez. You can correct me on my spelling. I'm not Hispanic. I can't pronounce things well. On February 29th, 1960 in El Paso, Texas. So Ricky was the fifth child of immigrants from Mexico. When he was a child, he was hit in the head multiple times, but the one that affected him the most was a blunt hit to the head from a swing. This hit caused Ricky to experience epileptic fits. And so, something to note is that Ramirez's cousin Miguel was a Vietnam vet who came home from the war, the Vietnamese war, to tell young Ricky about all the terrible happenings in the world. But Miguel also bragged about the torture and killing he'd done to the Vietnamese women that he had been around, showing Ricky photos of these women, even showing him posing with the decapitated head of a Vietnamese woman.
Wow.
So when Ricky was 13, he watched Miguel murder his wife point blank range, shoot her in the face because of a domestic dispute. And so Ramirez was arrested for the first time in 1977 for marijuana distribution and holding. And then he was also arrested in 1981 and 1984. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade, and that's pretty much where things went downhill for Ricky. Ramirez started his criminal career with stealing and selling marijuana, but quickly moved on to murder. So his first known victim is honestly not his first known victim, because as of 2009, his first known victim was actually revealed to be a 9-year-old girl when it was previously thought to be a 79-year-old woman. So, I'm going to read it in actual chronological order. On April 10th, 1984, 9-year-old Mei Luong was killed in the basement of a hotel Ramirez was living in. He sexually assaulted her, he raped her, before beating her to death. She was then hung from a pipe. This murder was not attributed to him till 2009, 20 years after he was arrested, because basically there weren't enough clues to kind of point them in the direction as to who did it, because it was a cold case for pretty much 25 years. And there's also a second form of DNA on the, at the scene, but they don't know who it is. So there could have been someone there watching Richard Ramirez murdering this 9-year-old girl.
Wow.
But they don't know. So basically, his then first known victim, which is actually a second victim, was Jenny Vincow, or Jenny the Cow, I don't really know how to pronounce it, who was a 79-year-old woman who was murdered in on June 28th, 1984. She was sexually assaulted, stabbed, and killed during a burglary in her own home. And so this was, again, believed to be Ramirez's first victim. And so this woman lived in a place that he repeatedly came back to, which was Monterey Park. And so then Ramirez did not strike again for 9 months, in which he attacked Maria Hernandez, who survived the attack by placing her hands in front of her face. So basically, Ramirez went to shoot Maria, and she put her hands in front of her face, in which Ramirez shot through her hand. And so basically, the bullet got lodged into her right hand. So when she wasn't killed, in which she kind of went and hid because she just got shot and she's terrified.
Yeah.
Ramirez went into the house in which her roommate was living and killed her roommate. Doyle Okazaki? Not Doyle, it's a Dale. I'm sorry. Dale Okazaki, I think that's how you pronounce it. I'm sorry, I'm bad at names.
It's all good.
In which she shot and killed her. So basically, because of his initial failure with Maria, in which he, again, when he left, he tried to shoot her again, but he missed and then ran.
Wow.
He went on to shoot and kill Tzai Liam Yu on the same evening. And so, basically, because of these two deaths in the same night, this is the moment in which the media kind of anointed him with the name The Valley Intruder,
mm-hmm.
and, or The Valley Night Stalker. And so the next kill was pretty much really soon after. On March 27th, 64-year-old Vincent Zazera and his 44-year-old wife Maxine were murdered. So Vincent was shot first before Maxine was assaulted and stabbed to death. Oh, by the way, just so you know, anytime I say someone was assaulted, they were usually raped, like sexually assaulted. So just a little key for you guys. Because I didn't want to say this person was raped over and over again.
Actually, the term sexual assault is only used for rape, like with police and everything.
Yeah, which is what I thought. So I just wanted to clarify that if I'm saying sexually assaulted, it means that that woman was raped.
Yeah, no, I was just agreeing with you that it's actually correct that when you say sexual assault, that only means rape. When police say they were sexually assaulted, that only means literal penetration. Like, anything else is different. There's different terms for it. But rape is sexual assault, and sexual assault is rape. There is just no, there's no, like, lenience with that term.
Yeah, there's no distinction, really, because they're the same thing. But, so anyway, so Maxine Zazera's eyes were gouged out from her head. And this is because she was looking at him, and he did not want her to look at him. And so their bodies were later discovered by their son, Peter, which is awful. Like, imagine finding your parents dead like that. Ugh, I couldn't. That's just awful.
Yeah.
The next one would be May 29th, 1985. So if you couldn't tell by now, Ramirez doesn't really have a very long cooling off period. Ramirez drove a car he stole to the house of Mabel Ma Bell, who was at home with her sister, Florence Nettie Lang, who was 81. So basically, these are both older women.
Yeah.
So Ramirez found a hammer that was in the kitchen and used it to beat Florence to death. Bell was tied up and bludgeoned before being shocked with an electrical cord. After sexually assaulting Florence, he used Mabel's lipstick to draw pentagrams on her thighs and bedroom walls. And so these women were found two days later, they were comatose but alive. But later on, Belle died of her injuries. And so the next attack is May 14th, 1985. So Ramirez went back to the place of his supposed original victim, Monterey Park, and entered the home of 66-year-old Bill Doy and his 56-year-old disabled wife, Lillian. So Ramirez surprised Bill by shooting him in the face and beating him before binding Lillian with thumb cuffs and then stole all of the valuables from their home before sexually assaulting her. And so Bill Doy died at the hospital. But I would like to note that thumb cuffs are really weird. They're like you just, they're literally handcuffs, but for your thumbs. And so I don't know why, if you're gonna use cuffs at all, why he chose thumb cuffs. I just think it's really weird. But I mean, he also was a Satanist, so there's that. On May 30th, 1985, Ramirez snuck into the home of Carol Kyle and bound Carol's 12-year-old son with handcuffs at gunpoint before re ransacking the house. So he then forced Carol to show him where the valuables were before sexually assaulting her repeatedly. He had then forced Carol's son into the closet at the as the sexual as attacks, but bound them back together before he left. So basically, he shoved her son in a closet, sexually assaulted his mother, and then bound them back together before he left. So, July 2nd, 1985, Mary Louise Cannon, who was 75, was beaten and stabbed with a lamp and her own kitchen knife to death while she was asleep. And that was it. He didn't steal anything. He just went in there, beat her, and killed her. On July 5th, 1985, 16-year-old Whitney Bennett was beaten while asleep with the tire iron. And so, since Ramirez could not find a knife, he used an electrical cord to attempt to strangle her before failing as sparks flew from the cable. And so, basically, Ramirez took this essentially from his words, he took this as a sign from God that he wasn't supposed to kill her and that she was saved by Jesus when basically he just took an electrical cord and it sparked, which is what electricity does. Anyways. So basically, he left her to die, but she survived. Even though she had to get hundreds of stitches because she was almost scalped. And then on July 7th, Ramirez was back in Monterey Park where he found 61-year-old Joyce Lucille Nelson, in which he beat her to death using his bare hands. On the same night, Ramirez went through to two other neighborhoods before settling back in Monterey Park and entered the home of Sophie Dickman, who was 63. He handcuffed her at gunpoint before attempting to sexually assault her. He insisted that she swore on Satan that he had everything in the house of value. So this is kind of really where he's continuing his Satanism thing. And so on July 20th, Ramirez purchased a machete before breaking into the home of Leela Knighting, 66, and her husband Maxon, 68, where he then hacked the couple in their sleep before killing them both with shots to the head. He then proceeded to steal any and all valuables he could find after viciously mutilating their bodies post-mortem. On the same night, he broke into the home of the Kenanth family. And so he shot the father, who was, I think, Chaneroy, I don't know how to pronounce that, I'm sorry, in the head before repeatedly raping and beating a stun kid. I'm so bad with names, I swear. I'm terrible with names. We're just gonna look back at the thing that I got this. Som Kid Covenant. And so basically he then took the couple's 8-year-old son and kind of bound him before he dragged the mother around the house to reveal the location of any valuable items at all, which he then took. And so basically he again demanded to her that he was being told the ultimate truth and that like she should swear to Satan that she wasn't hiding anything from him. And then August 6th, 1985, Ramirez then went to the homes of Chris and Virginia Peterson. And so he crept into their bedroom, which startled the wife, who was 27. And so he shot her in the face and then shot Chris in the neck. And then when he attempted to flee, Chris fought back while avoiding being shot twice. And then Ramirez then escaped. So basically, this is kind of the first time Ramirez was faced with, oh crap, these younger people aren't as easy to kill. Because previous to this, he'd been dealing with children and elderly people. And he was then faced with two 20-year-olds. And he barely survived. Kind of like, well, not barely survived. He barely got out of the house. And so both of the couple survived their injuries. On August 8th, 1985, Ramirez then drove to the home of Sakina Abawath, who was also 27, and her husband Elias Abawath, who was 31. And so he entered the home and then went straight to the master bedroom. And so he killed Elias with a shot to the head, and then he handcuffed and beat Sakina while forcing her to reveal the locations of any valuables before he raped her. He repeatedly demanded that she swear on Satan that she wouldn't scream. And then basically when the couple's child, who was 3 years old at the time, entered the room in which Ramirez was already raping her, he tied the child up and then continued to sexually assault the mother. And then basically after Ramirez left, the woman survived and untied her son. Basically, a lot of serial killers do this, but Ramirez was especially very keeping a close eye on the coverage that was happening based off of his crimes. And so basically he decided that he was getting too much attention in one area, which was Los Angeles. And so he moved to the San Francisco Bay Area. And so basically, that's why on August 18th, 1985, he entered the home of Peter and Barbara Pan. He shot Peter, who was 66, in the head, and then beat and sexually assaulted Barbara, who was 62, before shooting her in the head and leaving her for dead. And then, so basically, he also, again, from the previous crime, he used lipstick to draw a pentagram and the phrase "Jack the Knife" on a bedroom wall. And this is also, like, people have been seeing that he's been leaving sneaker prints and also bullets at all of these scenes, and they're kind of matching up. And so they're like, this is the same person, which doesn't help really, because it's just feeding Ramirez's ego. Because he's like, haha, you know what was me. But anyways, so on August 24th, 1985, he arrives at the home of James Romero Jr., who was just kind of coming home from a vacation in Mexico. And so his son, James Romero III, who was kind of just awake at that moment in time, because, you know, 13-year-olds are just kind of up and doing things in the middle of the night when they're not supposed to. So basically, James Jr. went to wake his parents because he heard footsteps outside the house. And that is when Ramirez fled, because he was like, oh no, okay, I'm not gonna worry, I'm not gonna risk that. And so James basically ran outside like a smart little cookie and went and noticed the color, the make, and the style of the car, as well as being able to keep half or partial license plate number of Ramirez's car. So this little 13-year-old who was awake when he wasn't supposed to basically just got a ton of information on an elusive killer that had been killing for a year at this point. sorry.
You're good.
And so basically that same night, Ramirez broke into the house of Bill Carnes, who's 30, and his fiance Inez Erickson, who's 29. And so Ramirez entered the building and into the couple's bedroom and basically awakened the husband when he essentially cocked his gun. He shot the husband 3 times in the head before turning his attention to Inez. And so he told her that he was the Night Stalker and forced her to swear that she loved Satan as he beat her with his fists and bound her with clothing from the closet. And so basically, he stole what he could find, but then he dragged the wife to another room to sexually assault her. And then he demanded that she help him find the rest of the cash and the jewelry and made her swear on Satan that there wasn't any more. And so basically she was like, that's all we have. That's like, please just leave. I swear on Satan, like, please, like. And so basically he was living from this ego. Like, he was feeding off of their fear pretty much. And so before he left the house, he told her to tell them the Night Stalker was here. And so basically she was tied at this point because he has a thing for binding people. And so she survived, and then she ran to the neighbor's house and was like, please help me, my soon-to-be husband is shot, the Night Stalker was here, he sexually assaulted me, like, please come help us. And basically Bill Carnes survived 2 shots to the head. And so basically, they removed the bullets from his head and he survived his injuries, which is insane to me. Like, basically, he was shot 3 times in the head and he survived. Like, the odds of that are insane. So, basically, at this point, Ramirez is getting a little sloppy. And so he kind of just was very cocky that he wasn't going to get caught. There was nothing that anyone could do. He was in charge of the situation. He was going to keep killing for as long as he wanted to. And so basically he wasn't really thinking about all the evidence he was leaving behind, like footprints from multiple houses and bullet casings. And then even though, like, Ramirez was trying to be careful, he was also being really sloppy. And so basically his photo from this evidence that they were getting was plastered on a bajillion different newspapers. And so basically on August 30th, 1985, Ramirez took a bus in Arizona to visit his brother, even though that he in like completely unaware that he was the lead story in pretty much every newspaper and television program on at all times in any state of the America. And so basically he didn't meet his brother, but he came back to Los Angeles on August 31st. And so basically, he completely walked past police officers that were staking the bus out, which is kind of funny to me. But he then went into a convenience store in East Los Angeles. And so this is when a group of elderly Mexican women or elderly Hispanic women were kind of like just looking at the newspaper and looked in and saw that's the killer. Because his face was on the front page of every single newspaper in the store. And so essentially at this point the people of this neighborhood started chasing him. They started running after him as fast as they could. He tried to run away from them and he attempted to carjack a woman, but he was caught and beat
Damn.
until the police arrived. And so they pulled him out of the car and started beating the crap out of him. This is like at least 100 different people that are just beating him with anything they can. And so basically, when the police arrived, he was begging for them to take him because
Wow.
he was like, please don't let me die at the hands of this mob. Because basically, these people in this little town here came together to stop the Night Stalker, which is honestly the coolest part of that story and the funniest.
Yeah.
So basically, he was arrested, obviously, and his trial started July 22nd, 1988, and he was famous for his first court appearance, in which he raised his hand to the sky, and which had a pentagram drawn on it, and he screamed, "Hail Satan," because he was like, "Haha, I'm a Satanist." But this trial went on for a little over a year, and so on September 20th, 1989, Ramirez was convicted of all charges, which means that he was convicted of 13 counts of murder, 5 attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults, and 14 burglaries. And so he was originally sentenced to the death penalty on November 7th, 1989. And so he was supposed to die in California's gas chamber, but basically that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so he kind of got out of it, essentially. And so Ramirez then lived for a few years, I think, until he was 59. And so he died, I think, in 2012. Let me make sure that I'm correct. Because some. Yeah, no, I was wrong. June 7th, 2013. So he died of natural causes. And so he died of cancer, pretty much, in his cell. And so that is why I said that earlier, he wasn't given the full extent of the law, because he died in, like, kind of in his home, like in his home in jail. And so that is essentially, that is Richard Ramirez. And so basically, he died in the Marine General Hospital in Greenbrae, California, June 7th, 2013. And so he had been on death row for more than 23 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, oh, I forgot another interesting really part about him. So basically, he had a wife. So basically, in 1988, which is when he was on trial, might I add, so after he was caught, Ramirez proposed to a woman named Doreen Leoy. And so basically, she wrote him nearly 75 letters during his incarceration, which is a lot of letters. And basically, on October 1996, they were married in California's San Quentin State Prison. And so basically, she threatened that if her husband was to die and was to be executed, she was going to commit suicide, basically. And so. But the funny thing about this is that he, when it was found out that Ramirez raped and murdered a 9-year-old girl, she left him in 2009 because she was like, I can handle the other murders, but not this one.
Wow.
Which is insane to me because you were fine with him raping and murdering all of these other women and men. But. Not, I mean, there is a line to be drawn on child raping and murdering, but I feel like that line starts when the words raping and murdering are uttered by a person. So basically, this little stud here, Mr. Ramirez, was then engaged to a 23-year-old writer. Pretty much by the time of his death. And so basically, this 70-year-old was engaged to a 23-year-old, which is insane to me, but it's fine. But yeah, so basically, people were essentially told that Ramirez was made a psychopath instead of being born a psychopath because he was kind of diagnosed with schizoid personality disorder. And so, which is why he was very indifferent to the suffering of his victims because in his mind, they weren't people. But yeah, so that is the Night Stalker. And then there's one other thing that another article that I have up. It was a really cool quote. And so basically, he was like, "You can't kill me. I am beyond things." And so he went, "I am beyond good and evil. I will be avenged. Lucifer dwells in us all." That's it. And so this is when he was 29, and he was basically, he'd just been sentenced to death. And so basically, yeah, that is the Night Stalker of California. That is Richard Ramirez.
Well, on that, it is time for us to take a quick momentary break, and then we'll get to the case of Joan Riche, which will be a little shorter because it's kind of a short case. It just, there's a lot of theories that go into it, so.
Yeah. All righty.
Okay, we'll be back in and
Hello.
we're back.
Just making
Okay.
sure you can hear me this time.
Yes, I don't know what happened. 'Cause like I started to hear like a giant echo, like I could hear myself over and over again, and then it
What's
was like
wrong?
silence and I was like, I'm so confused. So, hey guys, we are back. We have some technical difficulties, but we're good now. And now we'll be going on to my case, Tay's case, in case y'all cannot differentiate who's who.
Feel like they can. We have pretty distinct voices.
I know, but they might not know that Gia is your voice and Tay is my voice. You know what I mean?
Okay, well, I'm Gia.
Yes, and I'm Tay. That's what I was doing. So I am going to be covering the disappearance of Joan Riche. I'm doing another case in which it's a mystery, still has not been solved. I find a lot of interest in these cases because I feel like there's a lot of theories that could go into it, and that's really fun to discuss and kind of what you think could have happened. So we're going to talk about the disappearance of Joan Riche. We're going to talk about the case, and then we're going to talk about several theories that police and others believe to be true. So Joan Riche was born on the 12th of May in 1930. Yes, 1930.
Whoa, where it's an
I
oldie.
actually find old cases so interesting because they did not have the same kind of technology that we have today, or that even we had
Oh, yeah.
20, 30 years ago. Like, they did not have a 911 system, period. That's a
Oh, yeah.
big part.
Ooh, actually, that's a really interesting story. I remember I was listening to this podcast called My Favorite Murder, and it's a lovely podcast, two lovely ladies. I'm re-listening to it because basically they started in 2016, and I was like, I'm starting this from the beginning. I'm going to listen it to it from the start. And so basically, I'm listening to things that were kind of 4 years old. And they did a case that kind of was the reason that the 911 system was implemented. And so it's a really interesting case, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but if you are interested, it's one of the older episodes of My Favorite Murder with Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark. And so if you want to listen to a 4 year old podcast in 2016, they're still making episodes, but one of the episode that talks about this was from 2016. Go listen to it. It's really good.
So Joan Riche was born in May 12, 1930, in Brooklyn, New York. Her birth name is actually not Riche, well, obviously, but it was Joan Caroline Bard. So in 1940, her parents died in a house fire. The house fire was deemed to be suspicious.
Oh, boy.
And that went nowhere. And actually, in this case, Joan Riche is the victim. So that ends up having no correlation with our case at all. It's just
That
interesting,
gives me
like,
suspicious vibes.
yeah. It was just interesting because it was like, oh, well, her life started with her parents dying and what was deemed by the police to be a suspicious house fire. Like, it was weird. It was not usual.
Yeah.
She was 9 years old at the time, and Joan soon took soon after told an acquaintance that she had been sexually abused as a child at the hand of her family. So that was not a great start to her life. We're just going to start there. But it gets better for her. So she went to live with her aunt and uncle, who formally adopted her, and she took their last name, which was known as the... She was known as Joan Natras. She got a new social security number with her new name as well. So
wait, hold on. Did you say Natras with an N or mattress with an M?
N, as in Nora.
Oh. I'm like, wait, whose last name is Mattress?
No, are they, it's like, Mattress.
Selling mattresses?
No.
I was very confused.
So,
but I was...
Yeah. In 1952, she graduated from Wilson College in Pennsylvania with a degree in literature. She had a big passion, which she had a big passion for. So she actually did graduate from a college, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
In her spare time, she was always reading and writing. That's just kind of who she was, to get an idea. She got a job in a publishing company as a secretary, then moved up to a job as supervising the secretarial pool. So right off the bat, she is not a usual woman of the 50s. She graduated college. She got jobs before meeting the person she fell in love with. Like, she was pretty, like, chill by herself, let's just say. She became an editorial assistant at Harbor Race and Whirl, and later at Thomas Crowell and Cove, where she met Martin Riesch.
Oh boy.
Martin Riesch is her husband. Also, nothing bad about Martin Riesch. Like, the thing is, there is no bad guy in this case. It's so interesting. 1956, they got married. They moved to Ridgefield, Connecticut, and 1 year later, they had a daughter named Lillian. So Joan ended up quitting her job and became a stay-at-home mom. In 1959, she had a son named...
Sorry, my cat's being really loud.
No, you're fine. In 1959, she had a son named David. So in 1951, the family moved to Lincoln, Massachusetts, I believe. They lived on Old Belford Road. That's important because this all has to do with where they lived.
So Old Belford Road?
Road. They were quite popular where they lived. They were well known. They had house parties. Martin became an executive in Fitchburg Paper Company and often traveled out of states for work. Joan was very active in her community. While being a stay-at-home mom, she became part of the League of Women Voters. She wanted to become a teacher when her kids were older. Like, she was very an involved person. So this is kind of just a setup of her life, like a generalized idea of who she was and what she did and her family and her husband. So she has two kids, David and Lillian. Lillian's the oldest. So let's get on to the case now. On October 24th, 1961, Joan disappeared. That's the date. That's what happened. So the day started very, very normal. Martin woke up at 6:50 a.m. and he flew out to New York City at 8 a.m. So Joan went to a friend's house to drop off her son and took Lillian with her on errands. She drove a 1951 blue Chevy. She went to the dentist to have a cavity filled. Then she went to W.L. Grant pajama store and got underwear for her son and a bra for herself. It was just like a undergarments kind of store.
It was very much just kind of like an errands day.
Yeah, you know, she dropped off her son, her younger son, with a friend to watch him. And then she took her daughter and they went to the dentist. She went to get her son some underwear and she got herself a new bra. Like, this is normal day, you know? And the thing is, it was so normal. Like, I remember reading this case, and they stressed, like, this was the most normal day she could have had. She went and ran errands. Her husband just went, you know, went to do his thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the other thing. She paid in cash for everything.
Oh.
This was kind of just an important little detail, because when police looked into it, you know, she paid all in cash. She didn't pay card. So, check. So, the milkman and newspaper guys delivered everything during this time, and it was later reported that when they delivered everything, nothing was, like, out of the ordinary. So they have a milkman guy. This was a very usual thing. He would, come and drop off the milk at their door. And then a newspaper guy who would deliver their newspaper for them. And they were known. Like, it wasn't like today where the newspaper guy is just some random guy in a van dropping off newspapers. Like, your people at this time.
Yeah, because like they see your, they go to your house every day.
Yeah.
You say hi.
So after she was on her errand, she went to pick up David from Barbara's house. Barbara was her friend. And the neighbors confirmed that Joan and Lillian looked cheery, maybe a little tired from the errands, but really nothing was out of the ordinary. Like, there was absolutely nothing to think that anything was wrong. They
Yeah.
got home at 11:15 a.m. Between 11:15 and 11:45, the dry cleaner came by. Malton Kohlberg. He noted that Joan often kept her front door unlocked.
That's not good.
Well, no, see, because the thing is, during this time, that was also such a normal thing to do. There was
No, I
nothing.
know, but it's just it's the thing from like the 60s to like pretty much like the mid 80s. There was a thing of like, oh, I can leave my door unlocked. Nothing's gonna happen. Like, there's literally a killer who would go around to homes, and if the door was locked, he deemed it as and not an invitation to go in, but if the door was unlocked, then there was an invitation to go in. So it's like, I know that it's a normal for this time, but it still like makes me cringe because it's like, ah, no.
And so, but this was pretty typical. Again, nothing out of the ordinary, keeping her front door unlocked. It was a key in the story, but it was also something that wasn't unusual. So they went he went in, and because he would just kind of like walk in, like that's just what people did. It was very friendly. There were not the types of issues that we had today, period. And so he went in and had a quick convo with Joan, picked up Martin's suits to take to the dry cleaner, and left. It was later reported that there was nothing out of the ordinary, like it was just usual. Joan changed into a blue dress and white sneakers. She made lunch for the kids and put David down to nap at 12 to 2. So Barbara came
Sorry.
over with her son, Douglas, to have a play date with Lillian and dropped him off at Joan's house. Lillian and Douglas were playing in the driveway. During this, Joan did some chores. She watered her plants. She kind of stayed in sight of the kids. Like, she could see them from the kitchen. She could see them from
Yeah.
the garden. Like, she let them play in the driveway. So Joan took her kids to Barbara's house and dropped them off without telling her. This is an important part. Sometime in the time that the kids were playing in Joan's yard, Joan took the kids back to Barbara's house, like both kids, her child too, and left them in the front yard without telling Barbara she was doing that. She just did it.
Why though?
She left them in the yard, and Barbara had no idea the kids were in the backyard. So this is kind of important. So I think what was going on is she wanted the kids, like she probably told the kids, like, stay here, don't go anywhere, and the kids probably listened. And she just wanted them to be somewhere safe because she couldn't have them with her, evidently. At 12:15, Barbara looked out her kitchen window to Joan's house and saw Joan in a long trench coat with her arms kind of like out, carrying some red unidentified object in a hurry to either her garage or her car. So at 12:15, Barbara still does not know the kids are at her house. And so she just kind of sees Joan in her driveway, walking in a long trench coat, carrying, like, with her arms like out as if she's holding something, like uncomfortably. And it's a red unidentified object. And she was carrying it in a hurry to either her garage or her car. Barbara did
That
not
makes it
think.
look like she murdered a child.
No. I mean, because she just thought it could be like clothes, it could be,
Oh, my morbid mind went over it immediately to, you murdered my kid, Joan.
But, well, her kid, Barbara's kid was at her house.
Well, I
Oh,
know, but like she didn't know that.
So Barbara did not think it was out of the ordinary because she didn't know the kids were in her yard. Like, she was just like, oh, she's just taking care of things. That was the last confirmed sighting of Joan ever.
Jeez.
Around
Imagine the last
2:45,
sighting is of you in a trench coat.
Around 2:45 p.m., a witness said she saw someone wearing the same clothes described as what Joan was wearing, saw her along Route 2A, and she was seen to be wandering aimlessly. She was hunched over as if cold, wearing a trench coat, and it was 45 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, yay.
She was described as untidy. So, at 3 p.m., Virginia Keene, daughter of the neighbors, her name was Virginia Keene, said she was getting off the school bus when she saw an unfamiliar car in the Reisch driveway. It was a two-toned sedan. It was blue and beige. 5 minutes later, neighbors said they had to stop to let this car out of the Reisch driveway. So now we have two sightings of this odd car in her driveway. The milkman claimed to see this car 5 days earlier at the house. Oh. So another neighbor saw a car matching this description on Route 2A near their street. The same route that this other person was like, oh, I saw a someone that looked like Joan.
Mm-hmm.
At 3:30, someone spotted a woman of Joan's description wearing a trench coat, clutching her stomach with blood running down her legs. Same woman spotted at 4:30 p.m. near a construction site. At 4 p.m., Barbara notices her kids are at the house and dropped Lillian at her house in the driveway. So Barbara noticed that, like, her kids were at her house at this point, and she's like, oh, okay. So she, you know, walks Lillian back to Joan's house and kind of drops her at the front door. She was assuming that the front door would be unlocked, of course, because that was just, you know, what they did. And Barbara went to the grocery store. At 4:15, Barbara gets home to find Lillian in her yard, and Lillian says, Mommy is gone, and the house is covered in red paint.
Oh, boy.
Barbara left Lillian and Douglas at her house to go check on Joan's house. She immediately walks in and realizes it's in exactly the state Lillian said, but the red paint was blood. She heard David crying because his diaper needed to be changed, and she notices the blood was trailing up to the master bedroom where David was. Police were called and arrived in 5 minutes. They traced the blood from the kitchen up to the master bedroom, then back to the driveway. Blood was found on both the trunk and the hood of the car, then going out of the driveway in mysteriously just disappeared, like the trail. So also David's kind of young. He's like a little over one at this point, so he's kind of, you know, he's small.
But you mean he's not an 8-year-old who wears diapers? I didn't know.
So the kitchen scene, what the kitchen looked like was there was a table that was overturned. A phone that was normally mounted on the wall was ripped from the wall on the trash can bin that was usually under the sink and was actually in the middle of the floor. There was a phone book found near the phone. It was open to the emergency contacts page. So again, there was no 911. They had a page full of emergency contacts that you call. Like, you can call the police, but it's not a 911 line. It's like you have to call the police station.
Mm-hmm.
Assumed to be homemade due to the fact that there were no emergency contacts. Yeah, so, oh, another thing is when they opened the emergency contact book, there were no contacts in there. There was a blank page.
Huh.
So we think it was like a homemade phone book. The book was sampled and matched Joan's blood type, type O. Could not definitively say it was Joan's. At the time, they didn't have that kind of testing. No footprints through the house or blood. There were no footprints anywhere in the house or in the blood. It was estimated there was about a pint of blood total.
That's a lot of blood. It's not like a lot of blood in, like, as in losing half your blood volume is a lot of blood, but, like, losing a pint of blood just around your house is kind of a lot of blood.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking relatively, it will not cause you to die if you lose that much blood. You'll be chill. Yeah. You'll be just kind of need a cookie. So, there was clearly somebody who was trying to clean up the blood with a towel and a dress, because there was, like, a... Yeah, you could just tell. So nobody could say where the blood started, but it was assumed to end in the driveway. They found a partial thumbprint and palm print, neither of which matched Joan. And authorities called all the local hospitals, and none of them had anyone matching Jones' description had been seen. So police assumed foul play was involved. The search began for Joan. Police, military, and helicopters looking in woods, waterways, and all around the neighborhood. And nothing was found. Police started pulling together possible suspects. Martin Reich was cleared very quickly for being out of town. Questioned mailman, milkman, and dry cleaner, who all led to dead ends and were cleared. So now we have suspects. One of them was Robert Foster. He, part of trying to create the Minuteman National Historic Park, he wanted to buy some of the houses, including Jones. Neighbors described him as pushy and overstaying his welcome, but he was dismissed soon due to alibi.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was another man, his name was Harold Munder, out of patient from Belford Hospital, seen on Route A. He was seen walking into the woods, cut off a few branches, and put them in his car. Hours later, a cab company called the police and reported him as being suspicious while sending a telegram to his brother. He was dismissed for unknown reasons, and all leads the police pursued were dead ends. So, 2 years pass, and a reporter from the local newspaper, Gossin, he went to the library and found more information. He discovered months before Joan disappeared, she checked out 25 books from the library, all of which were about murders, mysteries, and disappearances, all of which has someone disappearing on their own, one of which was Into Thin Air, which was an eerily similar book to the book of a woman disappeared, only leaving a blood trail and blood-smeared towels. Over the years, there have been spottings, but no new leads. So now we're going to get into some theories. We have about seven theories maybe, but they're all pretty quick, so we'll just run through them. The first was that Joan was kidnapped. Now, this is unlikely just because none of this really matches up with a kidnapping, you know?
It really doesn't.
Why would she do all the things that she did? Why would she take her kids back to, like, it just doesn't make sense. The next one was that Joan was assaulted. This is also unlikely. It just doesn't make sense with how things were going. Joan did a lot of the things herself. She brought the kids to the house. It was just weird.
Mm-hmm.
Self-inflicted injury is the third theory, which left her disoriented with amnesia. I mean,
it's probable, but not the most likely solution.
Yeah. Next is that she suffered a mental break, which is also unlikely. So now we're going to get on to more realistic theories. First is that she was pregnant, and this would explain everything. She could have been pregnant from an affair, or she just didn't want to have another kid where she was in her life, so she had an abortion. And it went wrong, and she, like, hemorrhaged, and the doctor disposed of the body. Because here's the thing. During this time, abortion was illegal, period. Mm-hmm. And
if you got caught, you were done. Your medical license was revoked.
Yeah. So if she just didn't want to have a baby, she called a doctor to perform an abortion. This would explain why the two-toned car was at the house 5 days prior to do an evaluation, and then the day of. And the thing is, if a doctor is caught doing an abortion illegally, which doctors would perform abortions, they can lose their license and go to jail. So if the abortion went wrong and now she's bleeding and she's going to die, like, he very well could have disposed of her body somewhere, which would explain the two-tone sedan, which would explain why the blood trail ended at the driveway. Like, he could have put her in his car. Like, that would explain literally everything. It would explain why she didn't want the kids at her house, but she was okay with David being there because he was young and he wouldn't know what was going on. It would explain why the emergency contact book was open and why the phone was ripped from the wall, because maybe the doctor got angry. He's like, no, you can't call anybody. Like, you can't do that. Like, I will lose, like, my license.
I can't get caught. Yeah. You can't call anyone. You may be dying, but I'm not losing my license because of you.
Well, he could have gone to jail. He could have, you know. And so he could have been scared, and both of what they were doing was totally illegal. And so, yeah. And that's honestly the theory I think happened. I think that she was pregnant, she didn't want the baby, so she called the doctor, and yeah. So
that's very possible.
It also makes sense why there was somebody citing her saying that there was a woman holding her stomach and there was blood running down her legs. Like, that's what would have happened. So the next theory is that Joan was just unsatisfied with being a housewife and wanted to start new again. So she created this whole elaborate plan, and the two-tone sedan was to take her to a new place where she could have a new life. I don't like that one. I don't like that theory. And then the last theory is somebody broke into Joan's house while Joan was running errands. When she got back, they stayed hidden. She moved kids to be cautious, and when she went back inside, the intruder attacked her and later disposed of the body. This one would also make sense.
That would make sense, yeah.
So, that is the case of Joan Riche. Her body's never been found. We don't know what happened to her. It's a very open case. There's so many different theories that could go into what happened. So,
yeah,
that is kind of this case.
Let's pretend that Joan Riche just is in a cabana in the Bahamas, just vibing.
Yeah, and so that's the story. I think it's pretty interesting. I love that it's based in the 30s because I think it's so much more cool to look into.
She'd be 90s year. She'd be 90 year old. 90s year old. Jeez, she'd be in her 90s.
Yeah,
but she'd just be vibing.
I don't think that she's alive. I really don't.
It's time.
So those are our cases this week. I hope y'all enjoyed our podcast. Tune in next week for two more cases that we'll be choosing. And yeah.
Yeah. We hope you have a great week. And don't forget to lock your doors, because you don't want to disappear into thin air. And you don't want to get shot by a Satanist. So
yeah.
Bye.
Bye, guys.